Well, good morning. Good to see all of you here today. I'm going to attempt to make it through this morning in terms of speaking and preaching. So I have a good cold that I thought was on the downswing early this week. And then yesterday I got the classic sinus headache that has not gone away even this morning. So I'm a little bit under the weather, but we'll do the best that we can together. We're talking about the subject together of church history. And this is our sixth lesson, which I've entitled, Meanwhile in America. As we have focused a lot overseas, and we haven't talked about the United States, of course, we're dealing with the period roughly from 1870 onward in this section of church history. And so far, we've been flirting with those late 1800s. And we're going to continue to do that over our next couple of times together. Now, just by way of introduction, you will remember that last week, we looked together at the rise of liberalism and also Darwinian thought in the life of the church, all right? And we noted that in the late 1800s, with great correlation, there is a challenge to the accuracy and the authority of the Bible as Darwinian thought becomes very much in the mainstream. We noted that increasingly liberals began to see human nature, by liberals we're talking about Christian liberals, although this is true culturally as well, evolving like all of life. And so, increasingly, among liberal theologians, there was a call to go beyond what the Bible actually said and think about what they would think of as the trajectory of the Scriptures. And we noted last week that this is still true today. So you go to mainline liberal churches in America, for instance, and you ask them, how could you get to the place, or what brought you to the place that you would embrace, for instance, a teaching or a lifestyle like homosexuality, not only as, you know, just like we would welcome a homosexual person in here in order to preach the gospel to them, but embrace it as part of the church membership and even part of the clergy. I mean, how could you do that? And we remember we said that that's because starting back late 1800s, people began to say that there is a trajectory of the Scriptures that as human nature evolves, we evolve with it, and that we go beyond it. And now we have seen the full embrace of the law of love in everything. And so they wouldn't deny, in many cases, that the Scriptures actually teach against something like open sexuality in certain places. They would just say simply, we've moved past it, all right? And they don't have a problem teaching such things. Well, that all starts in that late 1800 period, and we saw this change in the way that people think. Now, this week, as I mentioned a moment ago, we're going to be asking what's happening in America, and specifically, what's happening in America in response to this rising liberalism. And again, we're not talking about political liberalism. We're talking about theological liberalism. We noted a couple of weeks ago that England has had some resistance to this kind of teaching in someone like Charles Spurgeon. But what about America? Now, we're going to get to that resistance in a couple of weeks. I'll be gone next week, but in a couple of weeks, we'll get to some of that resistance that begins to form in America to this liberal thought and teaching. But today, we need to set the stage for what's happening in America in terms of church life in the late 1800s. And that means we're going to kind of delve back into the early 1800s and into the late 1800s to see how things change here in the United States. And we really need then, as I note here on the slide, that we need some background to understand the effects of liberalism and the response that is given in America. And I'm going to focus really on two areas that just kind of give a kind of broad background to what sets the stage for an acceptance among American evangelicals of the late 1800s of liberal thought. How did it actually take root in America? And two areas we'll talk about. And the first is that of revivalism. Revivalism. All right? You say, what do I mean by revivalism? Well, America has had a tradition of seeing revivals happen among its churches and cultures and culture. So in other words, in the history of America, even secular historians are going to talk extensively about the revivals in America. And the revivals in America had two distinct features, have had two distinct features throughout its history. The first is a consistent call for sinners to convert, call sinners to conversion. All right? And that's one feature of American revivals. The second is a call for the saved, a call to the saved to live holy lives. Okay, so these are two features that have happened several times in great waves in American history. The first major revival is known as, anybody know what the first major revival, its title? It's Great Awakening. That's correct. The Great Awakening. In fact, again, if you read a good secular history of the United States, they will talk about this, very influential. First revival is known as the Great Awakening. This occurred in the 1740s, or 1730s and 40s. It was led by people like Jonathan Edwards, whom you see there on the slide, as well as men like George Whitefield and John Wesley. Of course, Wesley and Whitefield were not Americans. They were British citizens, but again, this is pre-Revolutionary War. The ties between America and Great Britain are very strong in the 1930s and 40s. The Great Awakening in the 1730s and 1740s was characterized by sound preaching and a call for repentance from sin. Now, and you had that coming from various stripes of the Christian, conservative Christian world, the evangelical world. Jonathan Edwards would have been a committed five-point Calvinist who was extremely evangelistic in his preaching and teaching. George Whitefield would have been a Calvinist, but he didn't make it essential to his teaching and ministry, though he certainly would not be afraid to teach it. John Wesley, on the other hand, was a committed Arminian. All right? Wesley and Whitefield got along splendidly for most of their life until towards the end they had kind of a falling apart. But in other words, what you want to see is that in America, all stripes of Christianity, conservative evangelical Christianity, is experiencing and preaching a gospel that results in a great revival. And so these leaders of Edwards and Whitefield and Wesley are leading this revival. And during the Great Awakening and even after it, there were many people who looked how you could produce a revival. In other words, why is it during this time period where literally hundreds of thousands of people are converted? I mean, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Why then and not earlier? Why then and not later? What caused a revival? In fact, you can read, for instance, Jonathan Edwards has extensive treatises on the subject of revivals, and many others contemplated that question. But in general, in the 1730s and the 1740s, the conclusion was this: we don't know. It's just that sometimes God pours out his Spirit in an amazing way, and the gospel takes hold, and people are saved. And how that happens and why that happens in certain time periods in great abundance, don't know. None of the times it doesn't. So there was, you know, that question was being pondered. Well, revivals continued to happen throughout the history of the United States. And after that great one, there was a thirsting for that to happen again. I mean, we're talking about in churches that had been historically gospel preaching churches that 50, 60, 70% of congregations were actually being converted, were being saved. And we saw that kind of effect and what that did to society. I mean, it transformed American life. Any good historian will tell you there is a direct line between the Great Awakening and the revolutionary ideas that come out of the 1770s. And not that the Great Awakening made people a bunch of individuals who hated the British crown. It's just certain values were instilled that Christian values that led a whole culture to see that they were different than what Great Britain was doing. So amazing things happen in terms of cleaning up society in many, many ways. And so people are thirsting for another revival. Well, another one seems to come from 1800 to 1820, and it is known as the Second Great Awakening. Second Great Awakening. It's a major revival. This revival, though, is characterized very differently than the one in the 1730s and 1740s. It was characterized largely by emotions and enthusiasm. In other words, it was much more emotionally driven than the one in the 1730s and the 1740s. It's during this period that you have the very famous American phenomena, and it is largely American, of the tent meeting or the camp meeting that begins to develop. All right? So you're all familiar with this? I mean, if you know your American history at all, you have people that gather in very primitive settings. Originally, it was largely a camp meeting where you would go out to a place and groups of people would gather together for the purpose of hearing preaching. And it started very small, largely among the Methodists. It spread to the Presbyterians and the Baptists as well. Those three denominations used the camp meeting, which later morphed into the tent meeting, greatly. These camp meetings were rather interesting during this time period. Originally, like I said, it started out with just the Methodists, and eventually Baptists and Presbyterians caught on. One thing that was very different in that time period is there was a lot more crossing of denominational lines in terms of working together during this period than there is even today among conservatives. The camp meeting eventually would morph into, you would literally have in some of these camp meetings, you would have a section that was devoted for the Baptist, a section that was devoted for the Methodist, and a section that was devoted for the Presbyterians. And you could kind of wander between the three and hear the Baptist preach, hear the Methodist preach, and hear the Presbyterian preach. And thousands, literally in some cases, tens of thousands of people would come out in single locations for a week on end simply to gather together for fellowship and to hear preaching. And much of that was very, very good. But there was also something that was very different than the movement in the 1730s and the 1740s, and that was that people felt by just doing something like that it could produce a revival. All right? It could produce a revival. And the key thinker during that time period is the man who's up on the stage, or up on the screen, excuse me. His name was Charles Finney. Charles Finney, a leading American preacher during that time period. He was a Presbyterian minister, and Finney believed some interesting things about revival. He has a lecture that he gave at a college in the United States on revival, which gives a key insight, which he later published, so it wasn't something he recanted, which gives a key insight into the way he thought about revival. Here's what he says about revival. He says, quote, "The revival of religion is not a miracle." Okay? And he goes on to explain this. He says, quote, "It is not a miracle or dependent on a miracle in any sense. Revival," he says, "is a purely philosophical result of the right use of the constituted means, as much as so any other effect produced by the application of means." Now, that's an older way of talking and kind of fancy older way of talking, but here's what he's saying. He said that if you created the right kinds of conditions, you used the right means, you could bring about a revival. Okay? Now, Finney's ideas catch on like wildfire. It's during this period that you have the come forward invitation that begins to develop. It was originally known as the sinner's bench. Finney invented that. Well, he may not have invented it. He borrowed it, but he certainly popularized it. And the idea was to use these means as a way to try to gain conversions. So one of the things that happened out of this time period, Finney believed that if you could use the right kind of means, that you would actually be able to produce a revival. And so it worked largely. These tent meetings and these camp meetings became the means to produce a revival. And some of the things that they did are still seen, they're largely dying now, but they were still seen in much of the 20th century in terms of using the right kind of music, the right kind of mood, the right kind of excitement, a much more forceful style of preaching, much more engaging style of preaching in order to draw people in order to produce a conversion. Finney's ideas, though they would not have stated things in the same way, were picked up on more modern revivalists such as D.L. Moody, Billy Sunday, and then Billy Graham. Now, none of those latter three would agree with Finney's theology, which at times really makes you wonder whether he was an actual understander of the gospel. But they did pick up on his methods. They used his methods because they were very effective in people's lives. Now, the result of some of this are rather interesting. First of all, as you think about the results, emotionalism was used, not exclusively, but it was often used to get conversions. Now, here's the thing. If you use emotionalism to get a conversion, how likely is that conversion to be genuine? Well, we just don't know. And it's ironic in what is called the Second Great Awakening may have ushered in a huge flood of people who may not have genuinely been converted as being admitted into Christian churches. Also, revivalism, by the time you get to the 1900s, you can tie a direct line, especially from the Second Great Awakening to the early 1900s, it's going to lead to Pentecostalism. Because Pentecostalism, at its core, calls for a highly emotional response. And you can tie from that 1820s to Pentecostals start really showing up as what we would think of as modern Pentecostals in the early 1900s. And there's a direct line from one place to the other. You also, as I mentioned here a moment ago, produced the modern revivalists that stretched out. Billy Graham is kind of really the last of the big-named ones. There are still smaller-named ones around today. But this movement is largely dying because our culture in America just doesn't respect revivalists anymore. So the people who show up to revival meetings today are largely not the unconverted, it's the converted, living in a day of bygone past. And I'm not saying that's all bad, it's just the reality of the case. It's a different era. It also, during this time period, produces a weak theology. And Finney is a good example of this. Finney was a Presbyterian, yet a committed anti-Calvinist Arminian. Now, if you know anything about Presbyterians, you know that they subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is by definition something of Reformed and Calvinist statement. All right? Finney gets ordained by the Presbyterians, and his ordination is never rescinded, even though he taught things explicitly against what Presbyterians taught. And one of the reasons that I think, it's kind of my theory, it's not just mine, there's a lot of others, one of the reasons that that is the case is because it worked. It seemed to produce a lot of results. Now, this is not to say anything about Calvinism and Arminianism. That's not the point. The point is to say is that the clarity of the issues were blurred, which meant that people weren't thinking clearly about theology and doctrine. And again, I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong here, but the issue is that those issues suddenly became not as important. And you can see this in all sorts of ways. Even, for instance, in these tent meetings or camp meetings, which were largely good. I mean, great results came out of many of them. But just the very fact that you had the Baptist, the Presbyterian, and the Methodist all in one place and people kind of floating from one to another led to a blurring of theological distinctions. So I am very happy, I would be very happy to have a gospel-preaching Presbyterian fill in our pulpit to preach, all right, now and then, or a Methodist, Or even, gasp, there are really good Lutherans that do exist out there today, all right? And I'd be happy. They do preach the gospel. I'd be happy at times to have them preach, okay? But what was happening here is very different, is that, you know, if we had a Presbyterian who came in to preach for us sometime and preached on a subject that on which there's great agreement between gospel-believing Presbyterians and Baptists, that would be wonderful. But if we made that a regular practice as part of our whole ministry, things would begin to break apart. And the tent meetings actually produce this. You have these revivals that take place that are trans-denominational. They cross denominational lines, which sounds good and appealing in one sense, but in another sense, it begins to break down clear theological thinking. So I genuinely pray for Lutherans in our area that are gospel preaching. All right. To my knowledge, the Wells Church, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod Church over near Cambridge, is a gospel preaching church. It's right on 95. To my knowledge, they would hold to a clear gospel. When I drive by there, I make it my practice to pray for them. I wouldn't mind having some personal fellowship with the pastor there. Wouldn't bother me at all. It'd be wonderful. But it's a very different thing if we came together and had a revival meeting together. It could be possible to do that, but in order to do that, every one of us is going to have to sacrifice certain theological distinctions to make that happen. Okay? The greater the partnership that you have between groups that differ, the more you have to ignore those differences to make those partnerships exist. So, good, bad, or otherwise, that one of the things this produces is a weakening of theology. So, revivalism, much good came out of it, especially in the Great Awakening, and even in the Second Great Awakening. Lots of people were genuinely converted, but there were also some troubling things that laid the groundwork for an acceptance of people who were not theologically, doctrinally clear by the time you get to the mid-1800s. In other words, if we didn't think that these issues over here were important theologically, along come people that start teaching a little more serious theological differences, even errors, and if we didn't think those were important to really hash out and think about, it was a whole lot easier to accept this, which then, once you accept that, would lead to this, to this, to this, until your errors become greater and greater and greater. And so there is some of this that comes out of this period. Now, a second issue that comes, and you could trace this also among the Presbyterians and also the Methodists as well, but I'm going to focus on the Baptists because that's who we are. And I'm going to use them as a lens to think about America a number of times over the next few weeks together. And that is Baptist associations become very important in laying the groundwork for how theological liberalism attacks in the United States of America. Other than Methodists, the largest group of Christians in the United States in terms of the number of churches established in 1860, so other than Methodists, the largest group of Christians in the United States in 1860 in terms of number of churches established were the Baptists. The Baptists and the Methodists, if you look at a chart of how many Christians there were, by far, they are the biggest players in the United States, Baptists and Methodists in 1860s. In the early 1800s and late 1700s, the Baptists were here in the United States. They began to grow very rapidly. And in the United States, as they're here, they had no national-type organization that held them together. All right? They had a number of local associations, even some new state associations, but there was no national group that held Baptists together at the turn of the 19th century, so the early 1800s. Now, Baptists have always, from their beginnings in the 1600s, believed in association and fellowship beyond their own local church. Baptists have always believed that. They recognize it because the New Testament shows it, that churches did associate with one another at various levels. They also see it as a value for doing certain things that one congregation alone would have a hard time doing, And at times also a bigger group of Baptists or whatever denomination is good because you can speak with one voice to a very important issue of the day. But in America, a Baptist organization did not exist nationally until a man named Luther Rice helped form one in the year 1814. Anybody know who Luther Rice is? He's actually a really important figure in the missionary movement and American life. He went with another important Congregationalist turned Baptist to India, Adoniram Judson. Adoniram Judson, you may remember, he was a Congregationalist minister who felt convicted to go and become a missionary. He was the first missionary sent out from the United States to a foreign country. Judson was heading over to the country of India to join up with another famous missionary named William Carey, who had been sent up from England. Judson was a Congregationalist. Congregationalists do not believe in baptism by immersion. Carey was a Baptist. So on the way over, Judson decided that he was going to study the matter out. We talked about this in church history a while ago. Judson decided he was going to study the matter out so that when he got there, he could try to refute Carey's claims of baptism by immersion. Got a long journey over his time period going over the waters to get to India. You don't have airplanes to fly there. Between him leaving the shores of America, he and his wife get to the shores of India, and they come both together to the same conclusion, that you need to be immersed after salvation, after conversion. So they got there, and shortly thereafter, they're baptized. Well, Luther Rice was actually on another ship coming over shortly thereafter, very shortly thereafter, to India as well. And Rice was in the same position. He and Judson were sent out, and he studies out the issue and comes to the conclusion himself as well that baptism must take place after conversion. So now you have two Congregationalists who are supported by Congregationalist churches to plant Congregationalist churches who have now become committed Baptists. All right? So this is rather awkward. And they know that it's not ethical. So what their plan was, since Judson was married and Luther Rice was not, was to send Luther Rice back to the United States to confess to the Congregationalists what had happened. Sorry, we were not going to take your money anymore. And show up to the Baptist and say, here we are. What do you want us to do? I mean, literally, that's what they did. So they put Luther Rice back on a ship and they send him back to the United States. He goes to the Congregationalists. There are no clear records of the meetings of that. I mean, I would love to have been a fly on the wall. Because truly, I do feel bad for the Congregationalists. Although, out of it, they expressed... they were not upset because it actually paved the way for them to think about sending out missionaries, and they began to do that themselves even more. And then he shows up to Baptist meetings, Baptist associations in places like Delaware and New York, and he goes there and he starts explaining, you know, what's happening and seeking support. And amazingly, the Baptists begin to support him in those areas. Now, Rice initially was, the idea was for him to go back to the United States, or go back to India, excuse me, leave the early United States there and go back to India. But it becomes very clear that he is much more needed in the United States to continue to raise funds and to organize further missionary efforts. So he becomes actually the American Baptists, early American Baptist, first kind of missionary. But he didn't go to a foreign country. His job was to raise money and organize so that other missionaries could go. This leads to a very early and rapidly growing Baptist movement of sending out missionaries from the United States, which still continues to this day. Well, Luther Rice, Baptists would form in 1814 the American Baptist Missionary Union. All right, they formed that in 1814. And later, they would form, these Baptists in the Northeast, would form the American Baptist Publication Society, which was to produce things like tracts and literature and things of that nature. Now, these Baptists would grow, and more people would join them. churches and Baptists were going to join them. And it grew into something that spanned multiple associations in something to a national association. And very shortly thereafter, there are churches both in the North and the South that are aligning themselves with these new associations. But unfortunately, there were tensions between the North and the South until they split in 1845. Now, this actually is a very key point in the story of Baptist life in America. Because what happens is it's not over the issue that you think, right? Initially, what's the first thing you think of that they split over? Okay, state sovereignty and slavery. It's slavery. That's really the issue. But that becomes important in 1845 when they split, but tensions existed really from the very beginning in 1814. The Northerners wanted a model of an association where individuals would choose to ally themselves with a particular association. All right? The Southerners said they would rather have churches associate with the association. Okay? So you see the difference? So, you know, you could go join whatever organization you want, give your money, your time, your efforts to support it. The Northerners largely argued for individuals. The Southerners argued for churches. That was really the key difference. And it was, they initially in 1814 adopted the Northerners' view, and the South increasingly felt marginalized. Eventually in 1845, with the addition of the subject of slavery, which was driving a strong wedge in America by that point, they split. They break up and they go separate ways. The Southerners, by the way, what is going to come out of them? Southern Baptist Convention, right? It's not initially what it's called, but that's what's going to be formed from them, which still is in existence today. The Northerners would continue on, and they would eventually form a whole series of associations. In addition to the ones that we mentioned, they would form the American Baptist Home Mission Society, the American Baptist Education Society, the Women's Home Society East, the Women's Home Society West. They had a division there for practical reasons, and also the Young People's Union, in addition to a whole bunch of smaller agencies as well. Now, it's actually kind of interesting how they came together. They came together every 3 years at something known as the Triennial Convention. It was also called the May Holiday for a while because it was held in May. And all of these organizations that you see up on the screen, plus other ones in addition, would meet all in the same place, but each one of those was actually separate institutions, separate associations or separate societies, which meant that they all had their own governing structure, their own governing board. And even though they agreed to meet all in one place, you know, you as an individual would go to these certain ones and you might go to other ones. There might be some crossing of the two. And as a result, you can imagine that this would create a lot of inefficiencies and also some frustrations as well. Right? So you have everybody showing up. They'd rent these huge halls or they'd meet in these big places every 3 years. You have Baptists from all over the United States who flood together, or all over the northern part of the United States, I should say, flood together and have this convention where they would do out the business for their various societies for the next 3 years, set budgets, raise funds, appoint new missionaries, appoint new secretaries, new board members, and so on. But you have all of this confusion that is happening between the three. Over time, this would lead to a call for these institutions to merge into one overarching institution. And that call began to happen after the Civil War was over. That's when the call begins to happen, for these institutions to merge. And unfortunately, that call is given in a post-Civil War time in which people are just trying to get along. They have just spent years of shedding people's blood, and they want to get along. And at the same time, we're talking now in the period of the 1870s, 1880s, and the 1890s, at the same time, this is when this call starts to develop to join these, at the same time, there is this infiltration coming over from Europe of these liberal teachers who are showing up in some of the schools and some of the churches that are represented in these associations. And this is going to set up a big problem as these begin to merge together, and that they're not going to focus very much on any differences that people have, but just trying to merge them for practical reasons and also in a spirit of just getting along. And eventually what we're going to see in 2 weeks, and in 1906, these groups form what is known as the Northern Baptist Convention. They all merge together into the Northern Baptist Convention. And when they do, from the very beginning, there are already liberal theologians and teachers and pastors who are already holding key positions in this new convention. For those of you who are familiar with the American Baptist, the Northern Baptist Convention today would be known as the American Baptist. All right? So if you've some of you have grown up or been associated with American Baptists in the past. That's where they come from. All right, so they're gonna form this new convention, and from the very beginning, they're going to have liberals in the midst. And this is going to create huge problems for Baptists in the North. And we'll explore some of that in a couple of weeks, and we'll also peek into Southern Baptist life and to see why they avoided largely liberalism for many, many years. And so that'll be coming up. So this is all kind of background stuff to get us to the point to say, how did liberalism get here in the United States, and how did the United States respond? And that's what we're going to look at 2 weeks together. All right, any questions or any comments? I got just a couple of minutes here. We're going to meet some interesting characters coming up very quickly. Yes?
I think it's interesting in the first great,
Awakening, yep.
You have people that are being educated about biblical truth. That changes their mind. Their mind is changed. And trust Christ, your personal Lord and Savior. Great emotion comes from that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think probably the people who follow Finney and others misrecognize what's happening there. I think they probably see the emotion, think if they can manufacture emotion. The interesting thing of it is somewhat effective. And if you're going to get real conversion out of an emotional experience, provided your emotions are educating you properly. The danger of it is the preaching is not sound. People aren't hearing the true gospel, and they're not encouraged to analyze whether or not it's a real heart situation or not. It can be a completely surface relationship with God, and then the whole idea of the seed falling on stony ground also comes into play here.
Absolutely. That's exactly what happens. And we still see the effects of that today. I mean, very much. You know, even today, you can go around and you can find churches that and organizations that that don't think very seriously about conversion. There's a large church in our area that I watched one time. They had a video of their baptism service, and they had a whole host of people being baptized at once. And at the conclusion of the baptism, after they were playing really evocative, emotional music during the baptisms as they're going forward in this large stage area, the pastor of the church gets up and calls right from that moment to the congregation to ask if anybody else would like to come right now and get baptized. Well, you know, I mean, you know, their argument would be, well, that's what Pentecost did, but that's a little different than what they were experiencing there. It was a highly emotional scene. And there were people who just came. You've just declared them publicly to be converted when you baptized them. You know, I'm not sure about that. That's a lot of trouble. Yeah.
I was a teenager. We went to a guy named Brian Rudd. He had a big blonde afro. But, I mean, he was sort of like that, very emotional preaching. And me and my friend, there was two friends. We all went up, you know, we threw our cigarettes in the pile. And to him, you know, we were converted and all this stuff. Well, Dave lectured, lasted one night. He was right back to where he was. Dave Rankin lasted a week. I lasted a month. And that was it. It was all emotional.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Yeah.
To him, you know, there was great conversion. There was great revival. All the people came forward.
Yeah.
It didn't mean anything.
Now, Finney would never have approved of some of the later manifestations of this, but you even, to, you know, in more modern revivals, you have staged events, things like, for instance, when the invitation goes forward, you have people selected in all points of the crowd who stand up and go forward in order to produce in people around them a sense in which they could do the same. They just follow the crowd. And you have that kind of thing. So, yeah. So you and this stems, so you can just imagine this, what that does in America, you know, during that time period. It just makes liberal teaching just wide open. Because if you have a whole bunch of people in your churches who are not converted, they will not see the difference, which is too bad. So we're going to meet some interesting characters, though, who start to rise up and resist this. Real fast, then we got to be done. So,
when these people are in these churches, a lot of times then, when you have liberalism, all this false teaching, they're not discerning, obviously. They don't have the spirit.
No, they do not have them. Yeah.
Why these little churches went the way they go?
Yeah.
The majority of them are not saved people.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So a couple of weeks, we're going to start meeting. Yeah. Go.
Just to bring it close to home, and we're now talking about the time period when this church was started and the Methodist Church in Taylor's Falls and the
yep.
Lutheran Church in Chisago.
Yes.
From this time period.
Right in this time period. And they would have experienced. In fact, it's likely the person who started, who helped found Sunrise Bible Church was an Episcopalian with Methodist ties. We're right in the middle of this. This is our history at this point, so we're just thinking about it broadly. All right, great questions, and I hope you'll come back a couple of weeks as we think about Baptists. We're going to meet the richest Baptist in the next couple of weeks in the history of the Baptist, John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil Company. Did you know he was a Baptist? A very strong one. We're going to meet him, and we're going to see what he does. And it isn't good, by the way. I'll just give you the answer ahead of time. And we'll see a bunch of people who try to resist him and others, and it's a fascinating time period.